This episode of The Charity Show is brought to you by The Good Studio, creating great content for good causes. Every week in charities and community organisations right across the UK, people are doing extraordinary things with limited resources. They're making the case for their cause, stewarding supporters, winning grants, running services, and somehow finding the energy to come back and do it all again the following week. This is The Charity Show, the podcast made by charity people for charity people. Every episode, we sit down with someone doing something brilliant in the sector and have a proper, honest conversation about the job, the challenges, the wins, and everything in between. Whether you're a CEO, a fundraiser, a comms professional, a trustee, or someone giving a few hours a week to a cause you care about, you're in the right place. If you're new here, hit follow wherever you get your podcasts. You won't want to miss what's coming up. And if you've been with us a while, a five-star rating takes about 5 seconds and makes a genuine difference to how many people find the show. So then, here's what's in store for episode 44.
Thinking about the sector in general, what I didn't quite realise is how much medical research in the UK is actually funded by charities. I mean, it's absolutely amazing.
How would you describe what you do?
It's someone who, you know, translates scientific language to, you know, normal speak, you know, lay language or something like that. But then from the communication side of things, you know, you need to understand what your audience, you know, wants to hear.
The Great Gift Aid Hunt is back for 2026. And if your organisation hasn't looked into this, you really should. Charities received about 1.7 billion in gift aid in the last tax year, but an estimated 564 million goes unclaimed each year. Welcome back to The Charity Show. I'm Piers Townley.
And I'm Tim Bainan. Great to be back, Piers, once again. How are you doing? I know it's been a busy March is a busy month for you. How are you? How's things?
Yeah, all good, Tim. It's really busy. It's the National Awareness Month for the brain tumour community. Various brain tumour charities, including my own, the Brain Tumour Charity, are massive month-long campaign for BTAM. That's the abbreviation of it. And there's a whole host of policy campaign fundraisers, a lot of content that we're doing with some of our founders for the charity. We have our big Twilight Walk in London, which is a big hero event, huge fundraiser. All the community come together, and there's a series of walks in London on the 21st of March. And then around the country, people are doing their own walks. Alongside that, we have bake sales and we have all sorts of things going on during this month. So yeah, really, really busy, Tim. And I just wanted to do a quick shout out to one of our high profile influencers alongside our high profile supporters. We've got our influencers that champion our cause, and they are particularly active during this month as well as throughout the year, but are particularly active this month. And a big shout goes out to Lisa Connell, who's living with a brain tumor herself and is one of our star influencers out there. And she's got a fundraising platform that links content and creators together, and it's called Influential Stars. Does a load of work for lots of good causes, as well as the Brain Tumor Charity as well. So a massive shout out to Lisa and her team and everyone at Influential Stars who are working so hard supporting the community, yeah, during Brain Tumor Awareness Month. So that's where my focus is for the next couple of weeks, Tim. How about you?
Yeah, not bad. No, not bad. Thanks, Piers. I know what those kind of focused times are like. They're hard work. But are you going to be walking yourself this month?
Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah, it's a really, really lovely event. It's, you know, a few thousand of supporters. It's an annual event, slightly different location this year. But it is a wonderful way to bring everyone together, to walk, to raise money, to get to speak to people you don't speak to people often. And yeah, it's a microcosm of what we do as a charity. So Twilight Watch is fantastic. Just hoping the weather behaves itself for it. But it'll be a great day, really great day on that Saturday, the 21st.
Yeah, they're great. They're great events. I'm going to do one in the summer for Prostate Cancer UK. There's a big walk that they March for Men, which they put on, which I'm looking forward to doing as well. So absolutely, totally agree. They're really important, really, really positive events. So good luck with all that's coming up this month. Yeah, not quite as busy a month as you've got on, full on month for you at the moment, Piers, but there's plenty going on in the world of the Good Studio at the moment. It's been lovely to chat to some potential new clients and see how I can help them out with some exciting projects that are on the horizon for them, which is really exciting. On the home front, it's been a busy time. I'm sure lots of parents of teenage children can appreciate the fact that it's GCSE option time of year at the moment. So had an evening with my daughter last night at school going over the kind of subject choices that she wants to do and that kind of thing. So that brings with it a whole world of sort of stress and all that kind of stuff as well. So I know, Piers, you've been there and done that with your kids as well. So that's an exciting time, a challenging time as well. And the other thing I wanted to chat about, yeah, I'm just having a look at this in terms of what's coming up on the telly. Because I don't know about you, Piers, but I really enjoyed the Winter Olympics. I thought it was fantastic. The Winter Paralympic Games starts end of this week as well. And Channel 4 have the coverage for that. And I'm really excited about what they're going to do. Looking at a little bit ahead as to what they've got coming up, an amazing amount of coverage on Channel 4 for the Winter Paralympic Games. The Winter Olympics were fantastic, and you know, I was just gobsmacked at some of the things which those athletes do. Absolutely spectacular. The Paralympics takes it to a whole another level, and it is staggering to see what some of these incredible Paralympic athletes do and what they're going to be doing at the Winter Paralympic Games, covering up downhill skiing. Athletes who have different levels of disability and different levels of impairment, you know, in terms of their vision, in terms of their, you know, missing limbs and all these different kind of impairments that they have, and that they overcome and that they compete with. And it's incredible, absolutely mind-blowing. So I'm really looking forward to the Winter Paralympic Games coverage coming up very soon on Channel 4. How about you, Piers? Did you enjoy the Winter Olympics?
Oh yeah, absolutely loved it. It's a weird one. It feels like it takes place in another kind of world, because obviously that kind of wintry feel to it, and that the way that it's covered is not the same as the non-Winter Olympics. But yeah, I loved it. I love the luge. I just think the luge is I was transfixed by it. Some of the drone footage was great, but just the idea of doing what they do, and it's kind of like, how do you get into that? How do you, like, one Saturday morning as a teenager, think, I'm going to become a luge expert? But yeah, absolutely loved it. I thought it was fantastic. And just like you, Tim, really looking forward to the Paralympics as well. Massive fan myself of the last leg and all the kind of support that they do for it with, you know, Adam Hills and Josh and Alex over there. So yeah, really looking forward to it. Looking to see what they do and the coverage of it. It gets better and better each year, I think, the catch.
Yeah, Channel 4 do an absolutely brilliant job.
Yeah,
and it amazes me every year as a runner when you see the Summer Paralympic Games. You know, you see especially runners with visual impairment being led by guides and competing at speeds faster than I thought I could ever run, which is, you know, mind blowing. But they do this in the Winter Games. They're doing it downhill skiing at 100 miles an hour. I can't get my head around the bravery it takes to do that.
Yeah.
It's just mind-blowing.
It couldn't be more of a challenge, could it? You couldn't add anything more to that mix than they already do. It's just incredible. Yeah, it is incredible.
Absolutely amazing. So yeah, that's going to be great. Looking forward to that.
Now, our guest today holds a role that most people in the charity sector will have heard of in theory, but probably couldn't explain in practice. We're talking about research communications. It's one of those jobs that sits right at the heart of everything a medical research charity does, and yet it's often the least visible part of the operation.
Katrina Tempsonate is Head of Research Communications at Breast Cancer Now, the UK's largest breast cancer charity. She started her career as a scientist, a biochemist, then a PhD researcher in cancer biology, before realising that what she really loved wasn't the lab work itself, but the stories that came out of it, the discoveries, the context, the question of how you take something genuinely world-changing and make people care about it.
She's been at Breast Cancer Now for around 8 years, leading a team of science communicators who work across press and PR, fundraising, social media, patient engagement, pretty much every corner of the organisation. And she has a lot to say about what the role really involves, what makes it hard and what makes it worthwhile.
We'll be back with the news a little bit later, but first, here's part one of our conversation with Katrina.
Hi, Katrina. Welcome to the Charity Show. Thank you so much for your time and getting an insight into science comms and your work over at Breast Cancer Now. Could you just tell us a little bit about your backstory, Katrina? How you got into science comms in the first place? What attracted you to BCN? I don't know if I can call it BCN, Breast Cancer Now, especially coming from a very highly acclaimed medical background as well. So how did you get into the sector?
I started off as a researcher, or yes, started off thinking that this is the career that I want to have. I did biochemistry. Afterwards, I went on to do a PhD in, some cancer-related basic biology. And at that time, I realized that I absolutely love science, but lab work isn't quite for me. You know, there were amazing moments where when you realize that you're probably the first person looking at one particular result, however, you know, niche or peculiar it might be. But I think what didn't quite work for me is the fact that sometimes you put a lot of effort into something and the results don't quite correlate with that. Probably kind of during the last years of my PhD, I was starting to look for what other science related jobs or careers there are where I could still use my knowledge, I could still stay close to the field, and this is how I discovered science communication. Yeah, so after I completed my PhD, I was lucky enough to get my first position in research communications in the charity sector, and I have been doing that for probably around 10 years now or so. Yeah.
So it's grabbed you. What would surprise you, Katrina, when you first joined that third sector? Was there anything that kind of struck you as like, I did not think it was going to be quite like this?
Well, I guess thinking about the sector in general, what I didn't quite realize is how much medical research in the UK is actually funded by charities. I mean, it's absolutely amazing. And, you know, I don't think it happens anywhere else in the world. It's probably a third of publicly funded medical research. You know, that funding is coming from charities. I looked up Association of Medical Research Charities data from 2024. 1.6 billion, comes from charities to UK medical research sector. And, you know, that compares to something like, 1.3 billion that comes from the National Institute of Health Research and probably another 0.9 billion from the Medical Research Council. So, that's government funding sources, but over the third of it comes from charities, and it means that people just galvanize around causes that are important for them. Whether that's corporate partners, whether that's philanthropists, and whether that's people who decide to take up a charity run or do a bake sale or donate a couple of pounds each month to causes that are important for them. They are powering so much of medical research happening in the UK. That's amazing. It's absolutely mind-blowing.
That's probably going to be a cause for celebration and also surprise for a lot of people, maybe just looking in at the sector, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's absolutely amazing. I guess on a personal level, coming from the lab into a charity, the most difficult thing was to get used to sitting at your laptop for a significant part of the day. You don't get a chance to stand up, walk around, do some experiments, sit down for 10 minutes and stand up and go do something around that. This is something that you...
You didn't bring your lab coat with you then to the charity... You didn't bring your lab coat with you to the charity sector, man.
No, I didn't.
It's really interesting to listening to what you're saying, Katrina, about the fact that... and also, Piers, what you're saying, I totally get that. Since most people don't realise or won't realise how much medical research is funded by charities and led by charities. But having said that, we all read the news. We all see the news. And pretty much every day there's a news report or you know, of you know, that quotes research that has inevitably come from charity work. So we might not necessarily think about it, but we do still see it every day because it's shown to us in the news. Given that really important aspect of the fact that it does make the news, and its role therefore is to, you know, inform people about the work of the charity as well as the research itself, how would you summarize to someone, if you were to meet someone for, you know, at a dinner party and they said, what do you do? What would you say in terms of the role of research comms? How would you describe what you do?
Well, you know, as you say, the role of science communicators or research communicators is extremely important for that. I think how it's usually described, or you know, I guess even a description that I have used in the past, you know, it's someone who, you know, translates scientific language to, you know, normal speak, you know, lay language or something like that. But to be fair, I think that doesn't quite do justice for the role itself. It's a lot more as just simply, you know, translating. You know, someone needs to really understand the research, and you'll be able to grasp it, you know, really quickly. But you know, not only that, they need to understand the context of it, you know, not only the findings. So I guess that's the science bit. But then from the communication side of things, you know, you need to understand what your audience, you know, wants to hear, how they consume that information, you know, what motivates them, and, you know, be able to combine these two. So, you know, it's not about, I don't know, educating people on the research, or you know, or just, you know, simply talking about that research in simpler words. It's, you know, it's in no way about simplifying research. It's about understanding what's interesting for your audience, and then, you know, talking about that piece of science in a way that, you know, that they will be able to understand, that they will find interesting, that, you know, will motivate them to, you know, start supporting the charity or continue supporting them. So, you know, it's a lot more than just, I don't know, translating.
I think Pearson and I could both appreciate that. Being working in the comms space for charities, obviously putting audiences at the heart of all that you do is absolutely central. So I'm really keen. We'll come on to some of that stuff in a minute in terms of some of that, how you go about translating some of that complex information into copy and communications that your audiences can understand. But first of all, just out of interest, can you talk us through what an average day looks like for you? What does an average day at Breast Cancer Now look like?
I don't know. I will sound cliche by saying, no, there isn't an average day. I guess at Breast Cancer Now, I am very lucky to have a brilliant team of four science communicators. So actually, they are the ones, you know, doing the, I guess, work on the ground, you know, interacting with researchers, writing, you know, the news stories, supporting our fundraising teams. So I guess my role probably focuses more on what we are doing in terms of science communications to, you know, build that, I guess, trust and loyalty for our supporters, how research shows up at, you know, brand level, you know, how we as a team are aligned to what the organization is doing. So it's kind of, you know, a lot of that, probably, you know, more strategic thinking and work, and you know, how we can do things better than we're currently doing, how we build relationships with different teams across the organizations, because we work, you know, we work with so many different teams. We work with press and PR, we work with many fundraising teams, we work with the website team, with the social media team, patient engagement team, you know, a lot of different streams of work that kind of, you know, that come to us.
Can I ask you on that front, in terms of working with all those different teams, how do you go about aligning calendars? Because obviously, coming from a charity background myself, I know sometimes from a comms perspective and a fundraising perspective and a marketing perspective, there can be clashes sometimes in the terms of the fact that you want to do something at a certain time, another department might want to do something at another certain time. You can't have two major things going on at the same time. How do you align things so that say you're working with the fundraising team and they want to put a major push out over the summer or over the winter, but you've got a piece of research that's coming up that doesn't quite fit that window. How do you manage that so that, you know, it'll work?
Yeah, I'm afraid I don't have a golden answer to this. Probably, you know,
I was about to make the notes so I could go back to my teams.
I guess that this is what we are trying to get better at breast cancer now is, aligning our communications better so that we can, you know, shout louder with one voice through all of our channels. Have we cracked it to the level that we want? Did you know? Probably not, but you know, it is negotiation, coordination, you know, trying to align things, trying to influence other teams. Of course, all of that happens.
Yeah, I think it's a common thing across with a lot of charities, I think. So yeah, I'd say it's a real challenge, absolutely.
To be fair, if anyone has an answer to that, you know, please contact me on LinkedIn. I'm, you know, happy to chat, happy to learn from that. I'm happy to steal ideas and do things better.
So just going back to sort of the relationships that you have, Katrina, I say Tim and I both have charity backgrounds as well, and you know, stewarding fundraising relationships over a period of time or high profile supports over a period of time. I think you've been at Breast Cancer now for like 8 years or so. So your relationships are obviously very, very strong with some of your particular researchers. How easy is it to build those relationships with the research community? Is it an unknown kind of question? Does it vary depending on the type of researcher, or is there generally a kind of a nut to crack in terms of getting the research scientists on board with your comms and on board as a charity?
That's a very good question. I think it probably varies from researcher to researcher. Obviously, you know, we have some researchers that we have been funding for many of years. You know, they know really well what the charity does. We have very warm relationships. So, you know, any asks that we come to them saying, oh, you know, would you be able to help us with this, you know, piece of comms, or, you know, with this fundraising activity, you know, they're very receptive to that. I think what probably helps in the charity sector is that, you know, we do fund their work. So I feel, you know, some of them kind of, you know, feel compelled to say, yes, we will help you with that, because they are getting, you know, tens of thousands or, you know, hundreds of thousands of, you know, money from the charity. So, you know, while I guess we never had to use it as a direct leverage. And, you know, I mean, we can't. We give money to research because that's the best research we can fund. You know, it's not attached to any conditions of you absolutely have to respond to every request that we put in front of you. You know, but I think that they do kind of feel some kind of sense of duty in that respect. So that's not necessarily a challenge. But I think what is important is to get to know the scientists and to really understand, you know, what strengths they have, you know, how they talk about their own research, to then be able to contact the right people for the right opportunity. And again, also know their interests. You know, we have some scientists who said to us, oh, you know, very happy to help with, you know, any kind of, you know, fundraising queries or, you know, or support on that side. But, you know, I don't want to be in the newspaper, on the media, talk to journalists. And, you know, we just need to know that in the first place. And I guess respect that and take that into consideration.
So I guess they're like any other stakeholder in the third sector, aren't they? You know, some of them want to be in front of the cameras, some of them definitely don't. But the job of the comms team is to translate or explain what they're doing, to convey the work that they're doing to the cause.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess support researchers, you know, to make sure that they just don't feel that we're kind of, you know, dropping them into the deep end, whatever we're asking them to do, and then they just have to figure out how to do that. Yeah, so I guess give guidance of, you know, how to talk about the research to whatever audience they're talking about, you know, what we're expecting of them. Answer any questions, you know, do debrief sessions if they need anything like that.
Now it's time for a little bit of third sector news. And my story this week is something I don't think happens very often. Parliament actually stopped and dedicated some time specifically to talking about small charities. So a couple of weeks ago, on Tuesday just gone, I think, Sir Ian Duncan Smith, remember him, led a Westminster Hall debate on the state of the small charity sector, and it was packed, which in itself tells you something about the importance of this debate. Now, there were some sector-wide stats in the debate. Only 30% of charity leaders think the sector is in a healthy state, apparently. 83% have seen demand rise in the last year. Only 1 in 10 say they've been able to meet that demand smoothly. Now, we've heard variations of these figures before, Piers. We've talked about this on the show quite a lot. But what struck me were the specifically small charity angles that Duncan Smith brought into the room. Now, firstly, the sheer scale of the small charity world. Around 96% of all voluntary organisations in the UK are small charities. That's pretty much the whole sector. And yet they're the ones with the least resource to absorb rising costs, the least capacity to chase grants, and the least visibility when it comes to government support. Then there were the actual small charities that MPs brought into the debate. Duncan Smith talked about Ripple, a suicide prevention charity started by a woman called Alice Hendy from her bedroom in Portsmouth after her brother very sadly took his own life. She built a browser extension that intercepts online crisis searches and offers a calming breathing exercise before pointing people to local services. It's been downloaded more than 2 million times from her bedroom, Piers. That's extraordinary. And that's really the thread running through this whole debate, that small charities are solving problems government hasn't even properly identified yet, and doing it innovatively and cheaply. But they're having to fight for every penny, prove their impact with almost no resource to do so, and approach institutions one by one to scale things that should be everywhere. The CSJ is calling for matched funding schemes and a dedicated evidence fund to help smaller organisations demonstrate their value and compete for support. And I think that's a conversation that's definitely worth having, Piers. What do you think? We've talked a lot about small charities before. We have our small charity spotlight in every episode. We know how important they are as a sector. And it's important, I think, that this debate has come to the fore. But of course, at the moment, everything is overshadowed by what's going on in the Middle East. So these kind of stories just don't get the airtime that they need, I think.
That's the thing, isn't it? It's like, oh, we're on the cusp of this becoming a real big thing in the news, especially in third sector news. And then obviously events have overtaken it. Hopefully it'll change back again. But yeah, it was amazing to see it being showcased, amazing to be talked about. As you say, Tim, we talk about the smaller organisations, the smaller setups out there that are the lifeblood of many, many larger organisations. It's just fantastic.
Absolutely. What have you spotted in the news this week?
My story is a little bit more upbeat this week because it's essentially about free money that a lot of charities are leaving on the table. The Great Gift Aid Hunt is back for 2026. And if your organisation hasn't looked into this, you really should. Here's the headline. Charities received about $1.7 billion in gift aid in the last tax year, but an estimated $564 million goes unclaimed each year. That's a staggering amount of money that donors have already said that the charity can have, money that HMRC is ready to pay out, and money that's simply not being claimed, usually because of patchy donor records, missing gift aid declarations, or just the busyness of running a charity with a small team. The campaign, in its entirety, is run by Swift Aid, with backing from the Chartered Institute of Fundraising and Just Giving. And previous versions of it have found that 98% of participating charities uncovered additional gift aid when they actually went back and checked their records. That's 98%. The most common culprits are incomplete declarations and donors whose details have changed over the year. Just Giving's own involvement has already unlocked more than £500,000 for charities through this initiative alone. So, how do you get involved? It's really, really straightforward. You head to swiftaid.co.uk. You can review your historical donation data to identify any missed or backdated gift aid claims. The deadline for submissions this year is the 24th of April. So there's still time, but not loads of it. It's generally one of those things where the effort required is small and the potential return is significant. We'll put the link in the show notes and everyone can head over there and see what they can do.
Amazing opportunity, I think, Piers. There's a huge amount of money that goes unclaimed, and that figure, £564 million of unclaimed money that's been gifted and given, you know, and is there for the taking. And people, you know, charities, think of the amount of work and the amount of good that money could do. £564 million, Piers. Imagine what could be done with that.
It's incredible, isn't it? Just for a little bit more of an admin. I know it sounds daunting and it's easy to say it, but actually SwiftAid have made the whole process really, really straightforward. So yeah, every organization should have a little check that out.
Yeah, actually, just linking back to my story about small charities, obviously they're the ones most likely to be leaving gift aid, or could be the ones most likely to leave, to be leaving gift aid unclaimed. So this is just absolutely directly relevant to them. You know, it could really help boost their coffers and give them that bit of extra spending power. So definitely worth getting involved in that. So good story that is.
Welcome back. We've been hearing from Katrina Tempchinarte, Head of Research Communications at Breast Cancer Now. And in part one, we covered how she got into the sector, what her role actually involves day to day, and why science communication is so much more than just translation.
In this second half, we go deeper into the challenges of managing researchers who may not always want the press attention you're hoping for, into the thorny question of misinformation and how a charity built on scientific evidence tries to hold the line when misleading health claims are pretty much everywhere, and into something that Katrina clearly feels strongly about, the difficulty of proving the value of comms work when so much of it happens behind the scenes.
There's also a brilliant moment where she talks about how Breast Cancer Now and Prostate Cancer Research join forces to fund research into metastatic cancer. And it's a really powerful example of what the sector can achieve when organisations work together rather than in competition. Let's go straight back to the conversation.
Katrina, can I ask you specifically about the comms side of things? And it's something that I've struggled with a bit in the past, in terms of, you know, myself when I try and do the you know, that translating of complex scientific information into, I don't want to say layman's terms, because you don't want to simplify it, oversimplify it. But it's a two-part question, I suppose. First of all, how do you go about approaching that, translating that complex information into stuff that everyday supporters and donors can understand and appreciate? Then how do you also keep researchers and medical experts and scientists on side so that they don't think you're dumbing down or oversimplifying their work?
Well, I think everything that you said is really key to the role of, you know, science communicator. I guess in this profession, you understand the risks involved, I guess, on, you know, on all sides, you know, overhyping something, you know, is a risk that, you know, can erode trust with, you know, audiences. And, you know, that's, I guess, especially important for the charity sector. You know, I guess it can potentially damage relationships with the researchers and things like that. I guess the approach we take in terms of scientific accuracy is we do consult researchers on key pieces. So if we are writing, you know, a description of their project when we start funding it for the website, you know, we do write it in a language that our supporters would understand. But, you know, we do run it past the researcher saying, you know, this is what we will be using. It will go on our website. We will then use it as a base for other communications. You know, are we happy with it? You know, we have written it, kind of taken into account, you know, what we know the people will kind of understand. But, you know, are you happy with it? So, you know, we do check in with them. The same with press releases as well. If we are announcing, a new research discovery, it is, well, you know, we wrote a press release taking all this into account. You know, do you have any comments? And, you know, sometimes it is a conversation, kind of going back and forth, the researcher saying, oh, you know, I think you need to mention this aspect of the research publication in there. And then we say, well, yes, we can do that, but maybe not quite in the sentence as you written it, because, you know, people won't understand the significance of it, or, you know, the terms that you're using. So I guess it is about finding that middle ground. Going back to, I guess, the first part of your question of, you know, how you go about telling that story to different audiences. I think a lot of that is, I guess as we talked a little bit before about understanding your audiences and also properly putting it in, you know, into context, you know, really explaining, you know, what difference that research has made, you know, why it's important. You know, while the research paper will be talking, I don't know, about a particular protein being involved in, I don't know, helping cancer to grow or something, you know, if you just say that, you know, that doesn't make sense, that doesn't help to paint that bigger picture. So, you know, you need to understand, you need to tell them why that's important, how that helps to solve an existing problem in, you know, research or treatment, how that brings us closer to, you know, whatever that might be, a new diagnostic test, a new treatment, how long it will take us for us to get there now that we have this new knowledge. So, I think there's a lot of that kind of, you know, contextual.
Yeah, you're kind of humanizing it, aren't you? You're kind of putting it, translating that data and that core information into something that a patient or somebody with that condition and will understand in terms of how it could impact their life or the lives of other people in that situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And whenever we have a chance to do that, you know, we try to get perspectives, you know, of people affected by breast cancer, where, you know, they can talk about their own experiences and they can express how they feel this research could, you know, change the future, or how it could mean that, you know, someone in their situation in, you know, 10 or 20 years, or, you know, however many years, won't have to go, you know, what they went through if the treatment was very grueling, or I don't know, there were some complications or anything else like that. So, whenever we can, we definitely try to bring that real kind of, you know, life experience of the condition, and get their input into what it means for them.
Can I also just ask on the news front, and you mentioned press releases there, and it just made me think about some of the challenges on that front that I've sort of come across in the past. Have you found that you might have on the one side a research team who's very excited about what the work they've done, and they're very keen to get a press release out there because they really think it's fantastic, but you know, from the PR side of things and from a comm side of things, that if it hasn't got necessarily a hook that the press might necessarily run with, then it might not get the traction that the research team hope it or think it deserves. Have you, are those difficult conversations to have in terms of, you know, I know you want this amazing research to go out there and it is fantastic, but it probably might not actually grab the press attention in the way that you think it will?
I mean, to be fair, I don't think I had to deal with a situation like that, or at least not recently. Okay. Obviously, whenever we hear about any new, papers coming out from our researchers, you know, we review them as a team together with our press and PR team, and for the ones that we think are newsworthy, you know, we do go on to promote them. We also then have a think, you know, maybe if there is something that won't grab the attention of journalists, maybe it's still interesting to our supporters or our audiences. And, you know, and if that's the case, you know, we still want to write that up and, you know, put it as a news story on our website, knowing that, you know, there are people that are interested in this. You know, it might just not have the kind of, you know, cut through to get onto, you know, front page of a newspaper or wherever you're trying to get that. So, you know, we don't just discard all of that. And I guess probably the third thing is that we might have some donors or funders who are supporting that particular research. So, you know, even if it doesn't have, I guess, a broader appeal, you know, they might be interested in hearing about that. So, you know, we might then consider just writing an update and sharing, saying, oh, you know, you funded this research, this is what it has led to. So I guess research, you know, news appearing in the newspaper isn't the only, I guess, yes, outlet for all of this. There are options and there are other things that we can do with that.
But I guess, like so many people in comms, it's almost a tightrope, isn't it, of managing people's expectations and then of also politely saying, no, you can't have BBC Breakfast, but you might be able to get some stakeholder research, or you might get some supportive information that may lead to, I don't know, a clinical trial. It's that lonely position almost of having to bat various demands on you as a research comms role.
There is an aspect of that, absolutely. As any comms role, there's nothing.
Would you say that's kind of the hardest thing about your role? Was that the most misunderstood part of your role, Katrina, or is it something else that's kind of difficult to articulate to people who don't really understand the role?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a very good question. I'd say that's not the most difficult part of the role. I think the most difficult part of the role is probably managing expectations from different internal teams, because we work with so many. You know, they have their own goals, they have their own timelines, and when all those requests come to our team, we just end up thinking, oh, you know, what's more important, supporting this press release, or writing this fundraising update, or working on this I don't know, cash appeal, or writing up this opportunity for our supporters to take part in research. How do you weigh it up if it comes from different parts of the organization? So I think that's the most difficult part. In terms of what's the least understood part, I guess it probably depends on your relationships within the organization. But maybe the most understood part is that, we do both operate in the research world and in the comms world, and the role, I guess, has the, I don't know, unique ability to bridge the two. So it can be a challenge, I guess, in certain setups, to be seen as, comms professionals by other comms colleagues rather than research brains. And maybe the other way around as well, as, research professionals or I guess people who have enough understanding of the research environment by the colleagues who work in research funding department. Building up those relationships and trust with both sides is extremely important to make the role successful. So maybe that's the bit that,
yes,
that is least understood.
It is a good answer. And it's also coming back to something you said just then about trust. And trust is obviously, especially with the research and the healthcare organization, healthcare third sector. I mean, over the last few years, we've all become our own experts. People are doing their own research, and the amount of misinformation out there, has that become a greater challenge for you and your team over the last few years, did you say? Handling that amount of misinformation or potential for misinformation.
Yeah, I guess it is a challenge that we are aware of, absolutely. I think that's a challenge that we don't really, we're not set up and we don't have capacity to proactively address, if that makes sense. So, we just can't go out there proactively looking for, what has been said wrong or what myths are flying around there about, whether that's breast cancer research or breast cancer in general. So I guess the way that we are trying to deal with is if something comes, directly, to us, if a supporter asks, I have heard, I don't know, this and that, what's your take on that? We can always then come back with a question that, with an answer that is, grounded in research and evidence. And I guess the other thing is then that, whatever we produce, we just need to make sure that it is evidence-based, that it is accurate, that it is correct. And yeah, I think this is the best that we can do without.
I guess it's being mindful of that. That is a lot. There's a lot of that out there. Whichever charity you're working for, dealing in the health sector, it's not going to go away, is it? So it's something that you are maybe as a charity you're prepared for, but just keep an eye on as part of your general comms.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess part of that is building your brand, building your profile as, you know, trusted voice, as, you know, experts in the field, so that, you know, people can come to us and that they can get the reliable information from us, that they can trust our resources, that whatever we produce is understandable and accessible to people, because, you know, if it isn't, it's very easy to I guess, disregard that.
Does it worry you, Katrina, on a similar note, does it worry you that AI and the fact that everyone is using AI to research, you know, for their own means or whatever that is, does it worry you that AI can get it wrong or they could misquote your research and it could give people false information? Have you come across that? Is it a worry? Is it something that the sector is concerned about?
That's a brilliant question. Entirely honestly, I haven't thought about that. I'm being, I guess, misquoted or misinterpreted. I guess it is. I mean, yeah, potentially is a worry, but I don't think we necessarily can do anything about that. It's probably, you know, a bigger piece around, you know, how to use AI responsibly. Minimize those risks that the information that you get is actually reliable. And yeah, all sorts of AI tools have exploded recently. And I don't know, I am secretly hoping that, you know, once we get used to using them, become more comfortable with all of that, that you know, we become more aware and kind of, you know, mindful of where they can actually, you know, add benefit and, you know, how to use them to their best potential, I guess, minimizing all those risks of, you know, misinformation, hallucinations, or, you know, I guess, whatever else there is.
Yeah. And that all information that comes out of AI, if they're quoting data and research, that it's properly accredited and that it's, you know, you can find out where those sources are and where that information's come from. Can I ask you as well, just about, because obviously it's the world that Piers and I don't know a huge amount about in terms of the research and scientific world. You know, we're not the most scientific, I'm speaking for you here, Piers, but we're not the most scientific of people.
No, that's about right.
Yeah. Tell us about the community, the research community across the sector. Do you all get on? Is it a competitive sector? Is there competition across research teams, especially if you're working in similar fields? What's that like? Do you have an arch rival out there, for example?
I don't know. Some people may do. It might be personality dependent. But I think that research community is generally, you know, very, very collaborative. I think all the probably, you know, easy questions in research have been answered. And I think there is that kind of wide recognition that one person single-handedly can't solve the problems that we're faced with. So, you know, it will require, you know, working together. It will require, you know, building multidisciplinary teams where, you know, people with different expertise come together and try, you know, really put their heads together to solve some kind of a problem. I think it's a lot more collaborative than it is competitive.
We've seen on the show before that you know, we've had on the show before, you know, charities have joined forces to achieve something. Have you done that as well in terms of Breast Cancer Now, in terms of working jointly with other breast cancer charities to achieve a common goal?
I guess in terms of research funding, we recently worked with prostate cancer research to, you know, join forces to collectively fund research specifically into metastatic cancer that spreads to the bone, because we know that it is an issue for breast cancer, it is an issue for prostate cancer, and I guess there are, you know, certain similarities between the two cancers too. You know, they are influenced by hormones, you know, be it female or male hormones. So there definitely is an overlap. And that's why kind of together we funded several new research projects to look at that. So, you know, absolutely. There is a reason to collaborate with other charities, and we will be looking to see where, you know, where we can do more together than we can do alone.
Sure.
I can see now why you do research comms, because I'm getting that sense of excitement that actually for a health charity or healthcare side of the charity, the next breakthrough could be just around the corner without obviously overhyping anything. But, you know, you are going to be at that forefront of these developments, and you can see these developments coming down the pipeline. It's an exciting role to have.
Absolutely. I guess you have to recognize that research takes time. You know, it can be 10 or 20 years down the road. But at Breast Cancer Now, we funded some very exciting research, and just seeing how it is progressing over the years is brilliant. So, you know, one of our researchers, Professor Nick Turner at the Breast Cancer Now Toby Robbins Research Center at the Institute of Cancer Research, he has been working on essentially a cancer blood test. Just last year it was used as part of a clinical trial to show when existing drugs stop working for advanced or metastatic breast cancer, and indicate that, you know, switching to a new drug would be beneficial. So, you know, it's very exciting to kind of, you know, see developments like that are, I guess, on their, you know, way to, you know, reach people.
What would your advice be, Katrina? You mentioned earlier that you, when you were thinking about your career and moving into the sector, and you were weighing up that whole lab coat versus desk debate, essentially. What would your advice be to others who are thinking, or perhaps facing the same dilemma? You know, they have a love of science. They're not perhaps sure where they want to take that. What would your advice be to them in terms of thinking about moving into the sector?
Talk to people in the sector, you know, get a sense of what they do. I don't know what the challenges are, what the rewards are, and, you know, try to understand whether this is something for you. I guess there are a lot of other roles that are related to science communication, you know, whether that's in public engagement, whether that's in outreach, but potentially teaching, you know, maybe something in policy, or, you know, that there's kind of all sorts of things that you can do, and where that research background can be beneficial. So just talking to people, or, you know, exploring the opportunities, and, you know, understanding what each role is about is the best thing that you can do, I think.
I know, Katrina, you've got a PhD, and I know one of your team members, Jay, who used to work at the Brain Tumor Charity, she has a PhD as well. So you wouldn't say a PhD is not necessary to go into research comms?
No.
It helps. Obviously it helps.
I guess that exposure to research environment probably, you know, helps to understand the field better. But, you know, it's in no way necessary. I think over the years we've seen an increase in master programs specifically focusing on science communications. Other people in my team have masters in their particular subjects. It's not about the qualifications. You know, it's more about the ability to understand the science and the ability to understand what comms is about, understand audiences, and kind of, you know, combine these two, see how we can tell that scientific story, and, you know, be able to judge, is this interesting to people, or, you know, is this only interesting to scientists?
And Katrina, when you look back on your career in research comms to date, is there a moment that jumps out to you that you're most proud of? And conversely, is there one that you found the most challenging?
I think I am most proud of my team. I have a brilliant team. They're great science communicators. I don't know if anyone's listening, please don't poach people from my team. I'll be very, very disappointed if that happens. But I think this is the thing that I'm most proud about is assembling a team that does brilliant work, that support each other, that can take pragmatic approach when workload becomes high, or priorities may not be entirely clear, and I guess whatever you see on Breast Cancer Now's channels in terms of research communications, that's all thanks to them. So a big shout out to Jazzy, Isaac, Jade, and Amy. They're absolutely brilliant, and that's the bit that I'm most proud of. In terms of challenges, I think one thing that I find challenging, and I'm sure that applies to maybe other comms roles and in charity sector and beyond, is how do you evidence and prove your worth, the quality of your work. Yeah, as I mentioned, as a team, we are working with so many different teams across the organization. But a lot of the work that we do is a little bit, behind the scenes. So if we raise a certain amount that goes towards our research, how much of that is our achievement, and how much of that is because we have brilliant fundraising teams who know the mm-hmm. audience, who build the relationships, if we get a great coverage for some of the research from our scientists, how much is that because we did a brilliant job explaining the research, or how much is that due to our press and PR colleagues who, maybe have great relationships with journalists, knew exactly what outlet to go to get that story flying. So, I don't know if anyone has answers to that.
I suppose the diplomatic answer to that is that you're all one team, aren't you, really? So whatever the result, you're all working to the same mission, aren't you? So I suppose it would be lovely to be able to sort of say proportion this to that and so on, but that's such a difficult thing to do. So I think probably the easiest way to think about it is that you're all focused on the same mission, aren't you, at the end of the day?
No, we are. And I guess I absolutely agree that whatever we do contributes to how much people know about breast cancer now, how much they understand that we do research, and what we're trying to achieve, how much they trust us, and how much they're willing to support our causes. So that's absolutely true.
Fantastic. And a lovely shout out to the rest of your team as well. It's something that we get a lot on the show. It's the teams. And it's everyone working together, really, rather than like the individual roles, Katrina. Thank you so much for your time on the show today. And we'll put all the show notes and stuff and the links into the show notes. But thank you so much for your time, Katrina.
Brilliant. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay then, now for one of my favourite parts of every episode. We spend a lot of time on this show talking to people running well-known, well-funded, big-name organisations, and that's really valuable. There's lots of learning there. We know that, of course. But the truth is that the charity sector is held together by thousands of small organisations, which we've already talked about lots today, that most people have never come across. Organisations run by tiny teams or entirely by volunteers. Organisations operating on shoestring budgets in communities that are often overlooked, and quietly, consistently, they're all changing lives.
They deserve a platform. So every episode, we shine a light on a couple of them. This is the Small Charity Spotlight.
And if you work for a small charity or you know one that deserves more recognition, we'd genuinely love to hear from you. Email us at thecharityshowpod@gmail.com or use the link in the show notes. Tell us who you are, who you support, and what will make the biggest real-world difference to your organisation right now. We'll do everything we can to get your voices on the show.
So who have we got this week, Tim?
Okay, so this week we heard from Susan Fletcher, who got in touch to tell us about Boys in Mind. And she said that it's an amazing charity based in Bath, supporting boys and young men to have healthy conversations about their mental health and working to prevent suicide. She said she's a very, very proud trustee. So thanks, Susan, for getting in touch. And just reading a little bit more from Boys in Mind's website, they state that Boys in Mind works in partnership with children, young people, and professionals in a range of settings to promote good mental health and to prevent suicide, particularly among boys and young men. Our work is guided by our three P's: prevent, promote, and partner. prevent suicide, promoting positive mental health and positive images of boys and men, and partnering with children, young people, schools, charities and organisations to make a difference. Now, we see this a lot. We hear a lot about charities that do great work to support men and children with their mental health. And this is another fantastic example. Local charity in Bath doing some really important work.
Great stuff, Tim. And for me this week, it's Sue Fishpool who's got in touch with us about Acuro. It's a small charity creating fun and inclusive activities and opportunities for people with disabilities in West Essex, helping them to grow in confidence and independence while parents and carers get a break, says Sue. Their impact is huge for such a small charity. Families feel hope and trust and lives change for the better. Thank you so much, Sue, for nominating Acuro. And from their website, their strapline is that Acuro empowers people with a disability in West Essex to feel less isolated, more confident, independent, happy and fulfilled by providing social opportunities and activities that are fun, safe and inclusive. So reiterating the recommendation that Sue gave us there for Acuro. So fantastic nominations there this week.
Absolutely. Two more brilliant organisations doing vital work with limited resources and enormous heart. Don't forget, if there's a small charity you think we should feature, drop us a line at thecharityshowpod@gmail.com or use the link in the show notes. And that's a wrap for episode 44. A huge thank you to Katrina for being so generous with her time and so honest about what the job of research comms really involves. Mystery to a lot of us, so fantastic to hear from her. Science, storytelling, stakeholder management, misinformation, the challenge of proving your own value. We covered a lot of ground, and I think there's something in that conversation for almost anyone working in the sector.
Yeah, just a fantastic episode, this one, Tim. I really love this one. And all the links from today's episode are going to be in the show notes, including everything from our news stories and links to Breast Cancer Now's work. And if today's show has sparked something for you, whether that's thinking about your own comm strategy, your relationship with researchers, or just the way your organisation tells its story, we'd love to hear from you. Get in touch at thecharityshowpod@gmail.com.
If you'd like to come onto the show yourself, whether you're leading an organisation, doing some brilliant work in a specific discipline, or running a small charity like those we talked about today that deserves a wider audience, do reach out. We're always looking for brilliant people doing brilliant things.
And please, if you enjoyed the show, leave us a 5-star rating wherever you listen. It takes about 5 seconds, costs nothing, and it genuinely helps more people across the sector to find us. More listeners means more stories, more voices, and more of the conversations that matter.
We'll be back in a fortnight. Give us a follow so you don't miss us. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time on The Charity Show.